You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rātū Tuesday. I'm your host, Caster, filling in for regular Tuesday Wire host, Alex, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Liam. In Whaakene, coming up on the show, for Dear Science this week, our expert Professor Alan Blackman chats to us about stress in sports, the chemistry behind the taste of beer, and Nobel Prize winner Dorothy Hodgkin. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with MP Ryan Hamilton about plans to scrap the Broadcasting Standards Authority, the government's stance on TVNZ and RNZ, and the proposed new test for immigrants. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi, Kestra. For Green World, I spoke to Richard Cappie, Chief Advisor of Forest and Bird, about the government's proposed Conservation Amendment Bill, which could make it easier for the government ministers to sell off conservation land, and what this could mean for Aotearoa's natural heritage. I also spoke to Martin Campbell, Vice President of the New Zealand Professional Firefighters Union, about the continuing firefighter industrial action in New Zealand, what issues the fire service currently face, and what the Professional Firefighters Union hopes can be done.
He aha, o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātohi mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Ooh, and we're here for Dear Science today with Professor Alan Blackman, as I mentioned. It's a fun time to be sciencing.
Well, I was just thinking, so we're getting rid of the Broadcasting Standards Authority, so I can swear like a trooper now, huh?
During Dear Science. Just yet. Not just yet. I mean, technically you could have sworn already because we're outside of the covered hours. You can't swear when there's going to be like kids in the car driving to and from school.
Oh, really?
But technically we're in the clear right now. That being said...
Here we go.
That being said, it's science time.
It is.
And we're starting off talking about sports, right?
Yes, yes.
In high-intensity moments, I mean, we've all been there, right? The stress gets to you and you might do as the article says and choke.
Yep.
What's going on?
Well, this is really interesting. Some people get all the really good jobs, like, well, as we will see. But for those of you who are not aware, which will be very few, I'm sure you'll know that the World Cup starts... on June the 11th, and when we talk about the World Cup, there is only one World Cup.
Yeah.
It's not the Rugby World Cup,
no.
It's not the Cricket World, it's the World Cup football.
Yeah.
And so that actually starts in Mexico on June the 11th, but it's actually June the 12th our time, of course.
Right.
And Mexico are going to play South Africa, and then the big game on the 16th of June, and how the heck this is going to go ahead, I have no idea. New Zealand against Iran in Los Angeles.
Wow.
I just can't see how that can possibly happen.
The Iranian football team, I think, has been given permission by Trump to play in the US.
Oh, how magnanimous of him.
I know. I mean, when I say given permission, I think he said, I don't care if they play, or something to that effect.
Dear,
so.
Dear. But anyway, let's concentrate on the football.
Mm.
And so the last time the World Cup was held in the US was 1994. Mm. It wasn't a great one from memory, but the final there was decided on penalties.
Unfortunate.
And the last one in Qatar in 2022 was also decided on penalties.
Yeah, and it's a bit less entertaining.
Well, it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
And that's the purpose of this whole talk. It really is seriously nerve-wracking. You know, because it was decided on penalties, that means that one person has to live their entire life knowing that their kick lost the World Cup, you know. And so you can imagine this is a pretty darn high-pressure situation. Your entire, you know, the entire world probably literally is watching. So how do you get around this? How do you hold your nerve in really, really high intensity situations like this? So as I said, some people get the really good job. So there's a guy by the name of Geir Jorde. I may pronounce that incorrectly, I'm not sure, but he is a Norwegian sports psychologist. And what he does is, amongst other things, he studies penalty shootouts.
Right.
That'd be a great job, wouldn't
it?
Yeah,
it does sound very entertaining.
be really, really interesting. And so what he found, talking of interesting, he found a bunch of interesting trends from his very, very, very in-depth analyses of many penalty kicks over many, many years. Some of them might seem sort of self-evident, but, you know, they need to be shown. They need to be shown that this is actually a fact. So, number one, as the stakes go up, the chances of missing your penalty kick goes up.
Right. That and does make sense.
Yeah. So, your average sort of backyard football versus the World Cup final, you know, you don't have as much pressure on you. So, that pretty much makes sense. Players are more likely to score a penalty earlier in the game rather than later.
Because the stakes feel lower.
Yeah, exactly. So when it's potentially less important earlier in the game.
Yeah.
And later on in the game, then obviously, you know, you might be chasing a win or something or chasing a draw or whatever. So there's a bit more stress there as well. The next one, penalties are more likely to be missed towards the end of a tournament.
Totally.
And again, so that's the whole stakes are higher sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You're getting towards the end. Everything starts getting more important. You're getting close to that final victory or defeat or whatever. And so that sort of makes sense as well. And this is an interesting one. So players are more likely to score in a penalty shootout if a goal means victory.
Ah.
So if they're kicking to actually win it, then
if the stakes are as high as they could be.
Well, but that's the weird thing, isn't it? So they're more likely to score in a shootout if a goal means victory, and they are less likely to score if missing means defeat.
Whoa. Hold on. So they're more likely to score if it means victory.
So if that shot means that they'll win it, they're more likely to do it. If the shot means that they're going to lose it if they miss, then they're more likely to miss it.
Right. So how does that balance out?
It doesn't really, does it? That's weird.
Yeah.
And he also analysed certain sort of patterns amongst the people who missed kicks. So they're looking very carefully at what they do in the lead up to the time where they're actually taking the kick. And so what they found was that, number one, that people who miss the kick are going to be more likely to turn their back on the goalie after they place the ball. Okay, so you put the ball down and then you turn around and walk back.
Yeah.
So seemingly that's not a good sign.
Not very good.
And then the second one is that the players who miss kicks are more likely to spend less time thinking about it. So they as soon as the whistle blows, they're straight into it, bang.
Well, I would have thought deliberating would make it worse.
That's what you would have thought as well. I would have thought, but apparently both of those things, so the fact that you turn your back on the goalie, that you take it very quickly, they're both signs of anxiety.
Right.
Which, you know, kind of makes sense.
That does make sense.
So as a result of all of this analysis, and, you know, being obviously a very good sports psychologist, this guy Jorde, he was an advisor to the England football team in 2018 when it was held in Russia. You may remember that one. And prior to that, the English football team was renowned for losing in penalty shootouts.
Yeah.
Okay. And it had got to such a point that they'd lost five in a row. Mm. And so they enrolled this guy, along with other sports psychologists, to see if they could help. And in the first knockout game in Russia, they won. This was their first win. And since that time, they've won two out of three since. So they seem to have, you know, done something right. But, you know, basically his advice is deep breaths and positive thinking.
Yeah.
Go a long way.
There really is a science to it.
Oh, absolutely there is. So I thought that was kind of cool. Very, very interesting stuff. Yeah. So, yeah.
And then this next one, beer. Right?
Beer.
We know it tastes good.
Football and beer, my goodness. We're talking about the good things today, aren't we?
Yeah. Why? Why does beer taste good is the question we're seeking to answer right now. Or bad.
Not so much why, but what.
What?
Let's say. What, yes. What makes it taste good?
Right.
Okay, so we're talking specifics here. We're talking specific individual things in the beer. So you know, beer drinkers out there, you all know what you like and what you don't like. Mm. I don't like things infused with hops to a point that where you can't bloody
drink
the stuff.
I'm not a big fan of extremely hoppy beers.
No, this IPA craze. No. I'm sorry.
A bit easier on
it. I'm sorry. No. Let's get back to good old lagers and stuff like that. You could actually sort of drink without having to screw up your face. Oh,
now this
goodness.
Is sounding like a football and beer.
So, beer is made up of literally hundreds of compounds, literally, okay? And so, therefore, the question is, why do, you know, which ones of those make it taste good?
Right.
Can we actually even do that? Can we take it down to a certain number of compounds that actually do influence the flavor in a good way or indeed in a bad way? And so there was a bunch of workers at Ohio State University in the States, and they thought, yeah, let's have a look at this. So what they did, they bought 18 lagers. Now, remembering that these are American lagers, probably shouldn't say that, but, you know, Budweiser and, you know, yeah, not much flavor there.
Yeah.
But
I think it's fairly agreed upon.
No. America does have good beer. They've got a whole lot of microbreweries and stuff like that. So
the big name lagers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they bought 18 lagers. They got 134 beer drinkers in to taste them and basically rate them. So, you know, which ones do you like best? Which ones don't you like, obviously? And so once they had these rankings, then what they did was they analyzed the beer. And they analyzed two things about the beer. They analyzed the volatiles, okay? Ooh. So these are the molecules that can get up into the air above the beer, and they give that beer the aroma, which is thought to be important. You know, it's not just taste, it's also aroma. It gives it that smell. And so they analyzed the headspace above the beer with a thing called GCMS, gas chromatography mass spectrometry, and that allows you to basically pick out those volatiles, shoot them through a machine. The machine tells you what they are, basically.
Awesome.
And then they would take the liquid phase of the beer as well, and they do the same thing, except they would use an LCMS, which is liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, same principles, etc. And basically shoot it through the machine, and the machine magic, and it tells you what it is. And so the volatiles give you the aroma, the what's in the liquid gives you sort of the mouth feel and the taste, okay? And what they found amongst everybody was that the aroma actually wasn't the most important thing. The most important thing appeared to be the taste and the mouth feel.
Right.
And that comes from the molecules that remain in the liquid, not the stuff that is in the headspace. And what they found, so through an analysis of all of this, they found four compounds that appeared to be in the liquid phase in all of the in many of the beers that people didn't like.
Oh.
Which is kind of interesting.
We've got the bad stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And so these all have very long names. We're not going to worry about them, but they are just they're just molecules, okay?
Yeah.
And here's the really weird thing. So they sort of narrowed it down to these four. And so what they did, they would take tiny amounts of these four and they'd put them in water and give the people their water to drink.
Yeah.
And they couldn't taste them.
Oh.
Couldn't taste them. But when they took the beer that everybody liked and they put the same amount of these four molecules in the beer.
Instant difference. Wow.
Yeah.
So it's the molecule that makes beer taste bad.
Exactly. It doesn't taste the water makes bad. So, you know, obviously it must be interacting with other molecules in the beer or something and forming something that they said it made it taste bitter and sharper.
Ah.
Okay. So which is absolutely fascinating, I reckon. And so the actual molecules, these four molecules that they've sort of narrowed it down to, seem to be related to actual molecules in the wild that defend plants against insects.
Right.
So, you know, there's a nice little link there, I guess.
Yeah, and you'd expect them not to be the tastiest of stuff.
So therefore, if you can isolate those things, take them out of your beer, it's going to taste better. As simple as that. There you go.
And last of all, we've got a happy birthday to Dorothy Hodgkin, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry.
She did indeed. And my bet would be that not many of the listeners would be familiar with her.
No, not me. I haven't a clue. I read that out sounding like I knew exactly who she was. No, I've done my research beforehand.
Okay.
But before today, I had no clue.
Okay. So it's her birthday today, and she would have been, 116, I guess. No, 116, sorry, 116. So as you can probably imagine she's no longer with us. But she was a an amazing chemist, and she was only the third female to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry. She won that in 1964. And what she got it for was determining the structure of a particular molecule. You've all have heard of vitamin B12.
Wow, that's one of the big ones.
That is one of the big ones, literally. It's quite a big molecule. And the way that she did it was a thing called X-ray crystallography.
Sounds fun.
It is. So crystallography sort of lies in the name. What you need to do is get crystals of your material. And so you luckily can crystallize vitamin B12. You then shoot X-rays at it. And these X-rays, when they hit the crystal, they essentially get bounced off in different directions.
Right.
Let's say that's a very, very simple view of what's going on. But they bounce off in different directions. And in her day, what would happen would they would have a photographic plate. And every time an X-ray hit the photographic plate, it would leave a spot.
Yeah.
And it would leave a spot of a particular intensity and in a particular position.
So you'd be able to measure sort of the shape and the layout. And
That's basically it.
Wow.
That's basically the way that it works. And in an ideal world, we would be able to focus the X-rays and get a nice little picture of what this is. But, but we can't focus X-rays. We can't do that. So therefore, we have to do some serious, serious maths.
Right.
In order to back calculate what your actual molecule looks like from where these spots are in space, their intensities and their positions and everything. And it's just a massive, massive job. And she was an absolute pioneer in this particular field of chemistry. And so she was, again, as I say, quite rightly in 1964, she won the Nobel Prize for determining the structure of vitamin B12. And then 5 years later, 1969, she deduced what the structure of insulin is.
Wow.
Now, there's a
That seems like an even more important one.
That's a very, very, very important molecule.
Yeah.
And it's way, 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 way bigger than vitamin B12. It's quite a large molecule, 35 or something, or 40 amino acids all joined together. That took her 35 years.
Whew.
35 years to do that. And nowadays, dare I say it, we could do it in a day easily.
Wow.
Easily.
So our technology's advanced that far?
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yes. And Auckland University actually have an X-ray diffractometer, which is top of the range, worth $1 million. They do wonderful stuff on it. I use it a bit. and it's absolutely brilliant. But so happy birthday, Dorothy Hodgkin. Now, she spent her academic life at Oxford. And in the 1940s in Oxford, she taught one Margaret Hilda Baker, who is better known as? Margaret Hilda Roberts. Sorry, goodness.
Margaret Hilda Roberts. Who's Margaret Hilda Roberts?
Well, her married last name was Thatcher.
Oh, well, that's not ideal. That's not, we shouldn't be happy about that.
And apparently, Mrs. Thatcher, as she was known, kept a picture.
As she was known. I can think of a few more things she was known as.
But she kept a picture of her scientific mentor, Dorothy Hodgkin, in her office when she became Prime Minister.
That's very nice.
Which, so, yes, Margaret Thatcher was a chemist. There you go. So was Elena Ceaușescu. Yeah, I know, not really good.
Not some very inspiring chemist.
No, sadly not. But ironically, Hodgkin was very, very left-wing. And her mentor was a devoted communist.
Wow.
Way back in the sort of 30s and 40s and everything, when it wasn't the right time to be there. As a result of that, she got refused entry into the US in 1953 because of her political leanings, shall we say.
That's unfortunate.
So, yeah, kind of similar to today, isn't it? Just a little.
Very accomplished.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for sharing all of these lovely scientific stories with us, Alan. And thank you to Moshat, as always. And thank you, science. Find out what the future of fitness looks like at Sports Tech, 23rd and 24th of May, a whole weekend of fun activities focused on the innovative world of sports technology. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Celebrate NZ Music Month with Mighty,
the teeny tiny venue featuring acoustic sets from some of your fave Kiwi artists, including Leao,
Geneva AM,
John Tugard,
Don McGlashan,
Reb Fountain,
Liz from the Beths,
and heaps more.
Mighty in Te Komititanga, May 5th till the 17th.
Free, no booking required.
Mighty is made possible by Auckland Live Interesting Things and Auckland Council Events. Find out more at aucklandlive.co.nz.
Experience the musical fusion of Saul Williams and Carlos Nino at the Tuning Fork this June.
If ever there were currents uncurrent, the wind cannot surf.
If you have a B card, you can be going for free. That's right, we have tickets to give away on Morning Glory. So grab that card of glory and listen out all week for your cue to enter.
Saul Williams meets Carlos Nino live at the Tuning Fork Tuesday, June 9th. Get your tickets now from tuningfork.co.nz. Biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Speaking of the Broadcasting Standards Authority, last week the government announced plans to scrap it entirely. It's the entity that serves to ensure television, radio and internet broadcasters across Aotearoa remain accountable to members of the public. While the government says it trusts broadcasters to self-regulate, it's unclear what this regulation could look like, especially without the all-encompassing BSA to ensure that a universal standard is met. In addition, ACT Party leader David Seymour has expressed dismay at some of the recent publications by state-funded broadcasters TVNZ and RNZ. With Seymour as one of the ministers in charge of appointing the board for each organisation, his comments and criticisms are being compared to threats of censorship. Lastly, the government has announced new tests for prospective immigrants to New Zealand, which would see them quizzed over topics relating to New Zealand values, our Bill of Rights, and our system of government. While the government is proposing this standard of knowledge for immigrants, many New Zealand citizens could be unable to answer the questions even today. I spoke with National Party MP Ryan Hamilton about each of these topics, starting with the Broadcasting Standards Authority. I wanted to start off today with the Broadcasting Standards Authority. The government's recently announced plans to get rid of it entirely. Why are those plans coming about from the National Party's perspective?
We just feel that it's time for a change. Like obviously, you know, you're going back to the days when television was one of the main platforms, and that landscape has obviously changed, probably incrementally at first, but now, you know, quite dramatically, and obviously lots of platforms and different streaming, you know, it's much broader than what the original BSA was set up to do. So I guess it's really, you know, moving to that next fit-for-purpose stage.
And does the government have plans to, I guess, have something in existence in future to ensure decorum is maintained on all of our broadcasters, be those on TV, on radio, on the internet?
I don't think anything's off the table. I think right now, you know, we do acknowledge that there is, you know, some self-regulation through the New Zealand Media Council, and some broadcasters have opted to be part of that. And that, you know, that might grow into become a primary regulator. But yeah, I think for now we've just got to work through this process and see what the next phase will look like.
The BSA also provided a channel for public feedback, especially, and without it, you know, is there going to be a place? Obviously, the Media Council you mentioned exists there, but it's not as much an avenue for public feedback in particular as the BSA currently is. Do you reckon there's going to be a place where people can hold our broadcasters accountable?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's something I think we'll have to wait and see, and sometimes it's not until you disestablish something that you can truly see where the gaps lie. I think self-regulation will likely grow, and probably be a practical way for the, you know, to level the playing field across platforms. And I guess it's almost like a peer review, or, you know, something amongst peers in terms of standards and expectations. But I think we just have to wait and see where the gaps are, and if there's a need that becomes, you know, clarified for us and, you know, requires government to step in, then certainly I think that's something we can look at.
Similarly, on the state of media in the country, I guess, Deputy Prime Minister and ACT leader David Seymour has been speaking quite strongly about TVNZ and RNZ recently in particular. He's been criticising both of these platforms for being biased in some way. Should politicians be trying to, I guess, or talking about media in this way?
It's always a tension, I guess. You know, textbook answer for you is obviously that the government appoints the board and sets clear expectations and then essentially gets out of the way. Obviously, when new governments come in, there's sometimes, I guess, legacy appointments from previous governments, and it does tend to colour the political inferences or assumptions that are made. And, you know, David's, you know, obviously obligated, well, not obligated, but he's within his rights to make his own comments. And as a leader of the party, he'll be wanting to, I guess, you know, find a niche for ACT and their followers.
Is there a line there between, you mentioned obviously the role of the minister in appointing the board for TVNZ and RNZ, is there a line there between doing that and then what he said about TVNZ's coverage being, I think the direct quote is, politically motivated?
Sorry, that was a quote from me.
From David Seymour.
Oh, yeah, again, I mean, I can't speak to his comments.
It also seems a bit hypocritical, I guess, for the government to be cutting restrictions when they affect broadcasters that the government has been appearing to agree with, such as the platform, you know, the BSA restrictions there have really come to light because of that ruling on the platform. While then David Seymour's talking about cracking down on these broadcasters such as RNZ and TVNZ, what's the difference there, right? On one hand, we're saying these broadcasters should be able to self-regulate, and then on the other hand, we've got David Seymour saying that there needs to be more control over these other ones?
Yeah, that's a great irony in politics, but you'd have to ask David more about that one.
Does the National Party have any opinion on those two broadcasters in particular?
No, I mean, our view is, you know, we appoint, the government appoints, you know, competent board members and chairs and sets generally through a letter of expectation what the government's, you know, response is. For RNZ, for example, you know, we'd expect them to operate in a financially sustainable way and measure their performance by their ability to grow audience numbers and improve levels of trust. I mean, that's essentially it. There might be other KPIs or, you know, micro indicators in there, but that's essentially, I guess, governance is appoint the right people, give them a direction and let them get on with it.
Also today I wanted to talk about the new citizenship test. Why is that coming about now from the government's perspective?
I don't know what the origin of it was for, but I think it's to firm up essentially or remind those that go through citizens the values of, you know, what it means to be a Kiwi, and just to make sure that they've got a base level of appreciation or understanding of some of our fundamentals, like freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and women having equal rights, which is obviously something New Zealand's very proud on and got a long history in terms of that gender equality.
Have you seen the test yet, or do we have any idea of what the questions might look like? And then after that, do you think it'll be made available to the public as well?
I haven't seen it yet, but I'd assume it would be publicly available. I don't think there's any, I don't assume there'd be any secrecy to it, because I guess people have to prepare for it. I mean, I assume they would, so I don't think it's going to be rocket science. It's just going to be ensuring people are aligned with our fundamental values, and so there's a base level with all New Zealand citizens that, you know, these are our values, and these are the basic things that we expect everyone, all Kiwis, to grasp.
Some of the stuff in there, particularly the Bill of Rights Act, is stuff that, I mean, most New Zealand citizens right now wouldn't have a very strong knowledge or strong understanding of. Are there any worries that we're, I guess, holding our immigrants to a higher standard than many of the people already living here?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I think to your point, if it can be made public or transparent, it probably could potentially show some gaps. You know, often we know things innately or intuitively, but it's not until they're made explicit that it actually makes you pause and reflect and think. So, that'll be a good question, and whether those things then need to get picked up through our education system, whether they are already implicitly or explicitly, I couldn't tell you, I haven't seen the test.
There's also been some concerns over the cost of the test. While the monetary cost hasn't been announced just yet, do we have any idea of what it might look like, given especially that some of our immigrant communities are not as, I guess, financially secure as some of the people who have been living here for a while?
Yeah, all I know is that it will be self-funded. I'm sure it'll just be a question of striking it. The balance between functional and, affordable.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton speaking to me about scrapping the BSA, David Seymour's criticisms of TVNZ and RNZ, and the newly proposed citizenship test.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Good Lies by Overmono. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Last week, Conservation Minister Tama Potaka submitted the Conservation Amendment Bill to Parliament. Amongst various changes, The bill has drawn a lot of criticism for its proposals to change the role of the Department of Conservation and make it easier for government ministers to exchange or sell off up to 60% of conservation land in New Zealand. For Green World today, I spoke with Richard Cappy, Chief Advisor for Forest and Bird, about what the Conservation Amendment Bill really means, the impact it might have, and the importance of preserving our conservation land for future generations. The government recently submitted the Conservation Amendment Bill to Parliament, which it says is the most significant reform of conservation legislation in nearly 40 years. What is this bill really about, and what impact will it have?
Yeah, so I guess conservation land is really part of who we are as New Zealanders. So this is like 30% of New Zealand, and it's like forests, wetland, rivers, mountain range, you know, those coastlands that connect us to nature. And this bill has kind of got quite a few different elements to it. So there are some sensible changes which could speed up low-impact concessions and improve the way, like, you know, DOC councils, community groups, iwi come together to plan for how we're going to look after conservation land. I don't think anybody has too many issues with those. But then it gets pretty bad pretty quickly. So first up is changes about who's going to make decisions about conservation land. At present, that's done through kind of local conservation boards, so local people and experts, and something called the New Zealand Conservation Authority, which is an independent group who make some of those really big calls about conservation in New Zealand for the rest of us. And what it's proposing to do is that ministers in Wellington will get the decision, the ability to make those calls. So I don't know about you, but ministers of the day with their agendas of the day looking at the next election, I'm not sure they're the ones we should be trusting to make calls about conservation land that's really, really special to all New Zealanders and that is so precious for Te Tāia, for our environment. Because this is the land we are we're charged with looking after just now for our kids, our grandkids and their grandkids. And it shouldn't be placed in the hand of someone who's got an eye on, you know, in this instance, November or re-election. So the other bits that are really concerning are they're proposing to be able to swap and sell off conservation land in a very different way to the protection that's in place just now. And actually, it means that 60% of conservation land would be able to be considered for disposal. So that is millions and millions of hectares of New Zealand land. Now, there are some safeguards around that, but they're pretty weak. So things like, you know, our most threatened species and where they live would be off limits. But places that are the habitats of what we would call at-risk species, so things like mohua, so kakariki, kaka, you know, creatures which by DOC's own definitions are in decline, they could still be potentially disposed of. You know, that's really worrying. Conservation land, we have it there for a reason, and that reason is to, you know, to be a safe place for these precious creatures, these amazing landscapes that we want to look after. We don't want to be selling them off. And then the final kind of piece of the jigsaw, or perhaps the most egregious bit, is actually changing the role of DOC. So this clause has been put in the legislation, which kind of shifts DOC's focus from being, I guess, a kaitiaki of conservation land for all of us to it being a kind of an economic development agency. So it should be, you know, looking at what it can do to enable commercial activities and economic development to happen on its land. And that's kind of casting aside generations of, I guess, a consensus around the importance of conservation for all of us. It really does place all of that at risk.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of changes in this bill. I mean, are there still any kind of oversight under this new legislation?
Yeah, there's definitely some oversight in there, but it's pretty weak. You know, and it puts a lot of power in the hands of ministers. And, you know, the Minister of Conservation, Tama Potaka, has come out and said, look, hey, this would just let us do sensible things like sell off some sections of land that sit between some houses in Reefton, or we could, you know, sell off the Met Office building in Wellington, which just happens to sit on conservation land. The reality is he can already do that. This isn't about being able to do those things. This is about shifting the focus of conservation land from conservation to really making it part of a broader call around economic development. And actually, you know, conservation land is there for future generations. Its value isn't what we take from it today. the value is that we hand it off in better shape than we found it. You know, this isn't like just normal land or an asset that we're looking to monetize. This is, by its very definition, land that we've said, hey, this is really important for conservation. We're going to make sure it's safe.
Which land are you sort of concerned about us losing from the use of this bill?
Yeah, so the conservation land that's exposed is, so 40%, so our national parks and things like that are supposedly off limits under this legislation, which is good news. So that's something that kind of sits under what we call Schedule 4. So that's the land that you're not allowed to mine or do kind of economic development on. It's the really, really precious stuff. But actually, there's another 60%, which is things like the Tauradura Range on the outskirts of Wellington or Mackenzie Country. You know, these are places that we know as conservation land that's really precious to us, that actually is in that 60% bucket that could be looked at. So, you know, amazing beach forests in the South Island, you know, amazing marine landscapes. So there's a lot of land that could actually be at risk here. And actually, that's not good enough. We as a country, we chose to say that conservation land is really special and we understand how valuable it is. We want to be able to use it for recreational purposes. There are different classifications that we've got in place to provide protection. And actually, we need to live up to that expectation.
Well, what would you see this bill being used for by the government?
Well, I think this is going to do a couple of things. One is that there is the potential to come up with some good changes around how things like conservation strategies work. So the way the conservation kind of system works, there's some tidying up that definitely needs to happen. But that change to the purpose of the Act and what the government wants DOC to do is very much signaling an overall drive around commercialization of the DOC estate. And actually, what the DOC estate needs, what conservation needs, is more focus and more investment on conservation, and it needs to retain that primary purpose. You know, conservation is so critical to us. You know, the minister said that 30% of Aotearoa makes $60 million a year. Well, actually, that 30% of Aotearoa, which is conservation land, a lot of which is completely inaccessible out the back of mountain ranges and things like that, but it is the financial and economic background for our primary industries. It's the fresh water we drink. It is massive carbon sinks. And, you know, the tourists who come to New Zealand who spend $18 billion a year, they don't come to New Zealand to go and check out Queen Street or Lambton Quay. They come to go and check out those special places and the amazing creatures that live there. We need to be investing and looking after that, not looking at conservation land as some kind of underperforming asset.
Yeah. How much pushback has there been against this bill? Are people even aware of it in the public?
Yeah, well, I think this is one of the challenges, right? So people are really worried about the cost of living. People are looking at the Strait of Hormuz. People are worried about, you know, some of the things that are very much in front of them. So one of the things we need to do is get people to sit up and take notice. You know, nature, you know, we're really clear, right? Nature cannot vote, but we can. So one of the opportunities people have got is to make sure they're signed up to vote and then be out there talking to their candidates as we're heading towards the election. Doesn't matter what political colour they are, ask them the tough questions. What are you going to be doing to look after our environment? What are you going to be doing to making sure that we're looking after our conservation? We need to lift that awareness because actually once conservation land's gone, it's gone forever.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, is there any scope for getting conservation land back or expanding our conservation land?
I think the key thing to do is just get this legislation right? You know, the bill needs, it was only put on the table on Friday, so it's just gone into Parliament. Chances are it won't get passed before this parliamentary term finishes, but we need to make sure that we're using, first of all, people are letting their MPs and having those conversations with their friends, having those conversations at the barbecue saying, look, hang on, I'm really worried about this. Get the message back to decision makers that this isn't good enough. And then that gives us the ability to be able to go in and have those conversations around the select committee table to say, hey, look, this bit of the law you've proposed is quite sensible. Let's crack on with that. But these bits here, actually, they're not good enough in New Zealand. We need to change those. That's the opportunity we've got. And to be honest, what we've seen with people in Auckland in particular around some of the fisheries reforms. And, you know, Jono's amazing swim was, if enough people go out there and say, hey, I'm unhappy about this, I'm really worried about this, then politicians will sit up and take notice. And that's what we've got to be doing around these conservation changes, making sure that candidates, MPs, people we know who are involved in political parties, all our mates, are aware of just how unhappy we are about you know, the risks that this means for all of us for many years to come.
Yeah, and what do you hope will be the debate amongst the political parties around this issue? And are you hopeful that more sensible policies will be implemented after the election?
Yeah, I'm always optimistic, right? I think, as New Zealanders, we care a huge amount about our beautiful mountains and the amazing rivers. You know, the incredible wonders of New Zealand are just so special to all of us. So I'm always optimistic that we can make the case to do better for those things. So, you know, the opportunity is there to say, look, what does a better conservation system look like? How can we make sensible changes? But at the heart of it, we hold on to this value, which is that conservation is something that we want to champion. We want to leave our environment in better shape than we've inherited it. And, you know, it's not like we're starting in really great shape. You know, 4,000 of our native species, so stuff that is only found in this country, is threatened or at risk. You know, so we think that our environment is in much better shape than it is. And we've got a lot of work to do to really look after what we've got. And I think, actually, this legislation is just going to make things worse, not better.
That was Forest and Bird Chief Advisor Richard Cappy speaking about the government's recent Conservation Amendment Bill.
That was The Green World.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Since March, firefighters have been carrying out two-hour-long rolling strikes every week, criticising the state of fire and emergency in New Zealand as a dire emergency. Firefighters have been calling for better pay, improved equipment and vehicle fleets, and an inquiry into fence. I spoke with Martin Campbell, the National Vice President and Auckland Secretary of the New Zealand Professional Firefighters Union, about the ongoing industrial action, what issues the fire service currently faces, and its impact on firefighters, and what the Professional Firefighters Union hopes to achieve. So it feels like every week we hear more news about problems with fire and emergency in New Zealand and about firefighters dealing with old equipment and appliances not working. What is the current state of the fire service?
Well, unfortunately, the current state is we are quite literally in a dire emergency, and that's no joke. What the industrial action has allowed our firefighters and our 111 emergency dispatchers and trainers to do is actually speak publicly about the concerns in fire and emergency. Without that industrial action, we have a gag order. We're gagged by media policy, but thankfully with industrial action, we can actually speak our voice. So we're able to bring to the public's attention the actual state our fire and emergency has been put in by the chief executive and his executive leadership team. It's an appalling state with fire trucks breaking down, fire stations closing down due to lack of staffing, 111 emergency centres having to be closed down and calls having to be taken from the other end of the country. It's a very terrible state that we're in, unfortunately.
Yeah, and what are the demands of the firefighters on strike and why is the firefighters union calling the current situation a dire emergency?
Well, we've got some just simple requests. We want our concerns listened to. We want safe systems of work. So firefighters, for example, have we're exposed to a lot more chemicals and things that make us more susceptible to cancers. So we want fire and emergency to recognise that if a firefighter gets cancer, that it's deemed to be a work accident instead of having to fight for a current process to say what fire we happen to get our cancer in, things like that. We want, of course, fire trucks that are fit for the purpose and can actually get to fire calls and are safe to use and don't break down. The average age of fire trucks across New Zealand are over 20 years old. That's how ridiculous the state of the fleet is in. We've got fire stations that are closing down because of a lack of firefighters and a lack of fire and emergency increasing the number of career firefighters across New Zealand. We haven't had any increasing in firefighter numbers since the 1990s. That's how ridiculous it is. When you look at, for example, the population of Auckland, 1.8 million people, we have half the number of career firefighters per capita than any other city in New Zealand. So we're in a real poor state. So we just need these concerns addressed.
Yeah, I mean, how did we get to this point and why has nothing been done about this before?
Well, we got to the point when the organisation was created back in 2017 when the New Zealand Fire Service became fire and emergency with the change in the Act. Unfortunately, since the creation of the new organisation, essentially nothing has been done to resolve these concerns around the fleet, around increasing the number of career firefighters across New Zealand, increasing the number of 111 emergency dispatchers that answer the public's 111 call in their time of need. We haven't had any increases in those. So it's pretty much the various chief executives, particularly this one and his executive leadership team, have just seemed to sat on their hands and done nothing, despite nearly a twofold increase in the take-home of the fire levies that the organisation is getting.
What is the union hoping to achieve with the strikes, and do you see an end to the current negotiations?
Well, we're hoping to at least get fire and emergency back around the bargaining table, because obviously if we're not at the bargaining table, this is just going to be here in perpetuity, unfortunately. So we need fire and emergency to come back to the table and actually start these discussions again with fire and emergency, how we can resolve these incredibly important situations that we have. How do we resolve firefighters being able to come to work and know that they're going to be safe and to be able to go home safely? How can we make sure that 111 emergency calls are going to be answered in a timely manner and that fire trucks are going to be dispatched to the public's emergency calls when they are calling 111 in their time of need? So we need to be able to get back to the bargaining table, and we need the chief executive to make sure that happens.
Can we expect any escalations if these demands aren't met?
Well, escalations are always, our very last resort. You know, the firefighters and dispatchers, we don't take this industrial action lightly. That's why we're only restricting it to 2 one-hour periods a week. You know, fire and emergency rolls the dice on a daily basis with New Zealanders. We have breakdowns and fire station closures all the time, every day, all day. 2 hours a week, that's the bare minimum that we're kind of willing to take to try and resolve the issue. We don't want to be in this position, and we're hoping that with a bit of pressure, the organisation will come to the bargaining table.
You were talking about how FENS was receiving more funding. Where is this money currently going, and where would you like to see it go?
Well, that's a good question. Where is the money actually going? The Parliamentary Select Committee has called for an inquiry into the fleet of fire and emergency as to where the current state of the fleet of the organisation is. Where is the money going that is supposed to be spent on fleet? We haven't had any new fire trucks introduced in the last 7 or 8 years across New Zealand, and this has caused our fleet now to become over 20 years old on average. You know, we've got a ridiculous situation where some of these fire trucks that our firefighters are driving in are actually older than the firefighters themselves. That's ridiculous. It's not what a proper first world fire emergency service should be doing. So the questions have to be asked is, where is the levy money being spent? Because it doesn't seem to be spent on frontline services.
Yeah. How does New Zealand compare to other countries in the world?
Well, New Zealand, you know, we rely very heavily on a volunteer model for fire and emergency, except in the cities and the provinces. So we've got nearly 10,000 firefighters across New Zealand. About 2,000 of those are career firefighters. But the majority of those career firefighters are in the cities and the provinces. So they're looking after probably 75% of the population of New Zealand, where New Zealanders live, work and play. So career firefighters, despite being a small number, actually are responsible for a very big part of protecting New Zealanders on their day-to-day lives. You know, when I mentioned before, Auckland has half the number of career firefighters per capita than any other city across New Zealand. That's absolutely ridiculous position to be in, 2026. We haven't had any increase in staffing since the 1990s. We've got a population now of 1.8 million people in Auckland. Urban sprawl is going up and it is going out, and we are taking longer to get to people's emergencies. That needs to be addressed.
The executive this year got a substantial pay rise. salaries for firefighters have not really changed in the last few years. What does this say about FENZ and its leadership?
Well, there's something to be said about the the executive leadership and the board. The board got a 75% increase for their annual salaries. Firefighters haven't had an increase in their pay since 2024. So, you know, that's, what are we now, almost 2 years now without a pay rise. So that's, you know, things are, as we can see out in the world, are getting very expensive. One only needs to try and fill their car up now to see how expensive it is to fill a car up. We haven't had pay rises in over 2 years. Firefighters are starting to hurt, and it's, you know, it's symptomatic of an organisation that seems to not care about its staff and not care about the operational side of the organisation.
In terms of solutions, do you think central government should have a greater role in managing New Zealand's emergency services?
Well, there certainly needs. There's been talk about the, how the organisation is funded in general. The can's been kicked down the road several times by several governments on that. How the organisation is funded is one conversation. We kind of argue that the organisation has a significant amount of funding through the fire levies. It's whether that funding has actually been spent on the right places. You know, the organisation wasted $60 million on a payroll project that went absolutely nowhere. We've had like nearly $10 million spent on uniform projects that have gone nowhere. There seems to be a massive amount of wastage of public money being spent by the organisation, and there doesn't seem to be any accountability for any senior management as to this wastage of money. So we kind of have to say is, maybe the funding model needs to be looked at, but certainly the money that the organisation does get needs to be reviewed as to where is it going and is it going in the right place.
I've been reading a bit about the history of firefighting in New Zealand, and it seems major reforms in firefighting only began to be implemented after the disastrous 1947 Ballantines fire, which claimed 41 lives. Do you worry that it might take another catastrophe to implement the necessary changes in the fire service?
It's always a concern. The Ballantines fire, yeah, like you say, back in 47, 48, was a massive wake-up call to New Zealand back in the time, and we had the National Fire Service Act implemented soon after that. And that got reviewed in 1975, but now we have the Fire and Emergency Act that was instigated in 2017, and the fire service was disestablished and fire and emergency was created. Whether that is working, is still to be seen. I would sort of wonder, you know, are we a better organisation as fire and emergency in the sense of are we able to provide a better job now than we were as the New Zealand Fire Service? I'm not sure about that. It certainly doesn't seem it to frontline firefighters and frontline staff that we're able to do a better job. That, you know, that needs to be seen. Again, it comes back to the funding and the leadership of the organisation seems to be very wanting and not where it needs to be.
But are you worried that we might be putting lives at risk?
Lives are being put every day on the line by fire and emergency. Every time a fire truck breaks down and fails to get to a fire is a danger to the public. Every time a fire station has to close because there's not enough career firefighters to staff the station, that's a major danger to the public every day. Every time a fire truck is running short, that's a danger to firefighters and the public. Every time your 111 emergency call centre has to close down, that's a danger to the public who are making having to make the 111 calls. So yeah, there's no doubt about it. The public is being endangered on a daily basis by the leadership of the fire and emergency and the decisions they are making and the priorities that they seem to be leading the organisation towards. So, yes, there's a real concern that there is a danger to the public and there may be another disaster could potentially be a result.
And with an election coming up, are you hopeful that we might see any changes?
Well, always hopeful that we see changes. The election has spurred some government parties to maybe wake up and take a notice. You know, we appreciate any help from any political party that is willing to take on our concerns and to try and hold the organisation to account and to try and get some positive change to make us safer New Zealand.
That was Martin Campbell, Vice President of the New Zealand Professional Firefighters Union, speaking about the ongoing firefighter strikes.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, National MP Ryan Hamilton, Richard Cappy from Forest and Bird, and New Zealand Professional Firefighters Union Vice President Martin Campbell. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.